Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, we've got some really good news to start off with today. It's a story that you reported on extensively and exclusively for National Review, and that was the Louisiana governor's race. It was never close, which is why the mainstream media probably didn't even let most of our listeners know that there was a gubernatorial election in Louisiana on Saturday, but there was. Louisiana's got some interesting rules because the winner has to get more than 50% in order to avoid a runoff. Bobby Jindal easily did that, 65%, almost 66% of the vote. Four Democrats in the race, only one of them even in double digits percentage-wise. You obviously spent some time with him in the last month and figured out not only what he's accomplished in the last 4 years, but why he's wasn't such a dominant position to win re-election. So I'm sure this came as no surprise to you.
It didn't. The only question was how large was the margin of victory going to be? You kind of laid out the unusual system they have. Basically, they have a primary day in which everybody votes. Every candidate is listed, and then usually the top two finishers, and usually it's a Democrat and a Republican, they go to a runoff that's held in November. Well, when you have one overwhelmingly popular candidate, like the incumbent, like Bobby Jindal, and no major opposition. I mean, you mentioned there are four Democrats on the ballot, but in the end, none of them have run for office before. I think the best known is this school teacher who had, I believe, at 1.6% of the campaign cash that Bobby Jindal had. So not exactly an even fight in terms of spending. But I think what more significantly is that the Democratic State Committee chose not to endorse any of the four candidates running under the Democratic Party label into this election. That, to me, kind of struck me as the ultimate example of really no Democrat of any significance really wants to contest what Bobby Jindal has done in the past 4 years. And so, thankfully, my big story that's in the magazine is now on the homepage of National Review Online. People, it's now been opened up for the whole world to see. I still think people should go out and buy that magazine. I think you should buy that magazine every single week. But even if you don't, check it out. You can leave comments. It's just an amazing record. And I suppose we should point out that, look, Bobby Jindal takes over in 2007 in a state that really has hit bottom. Katrina was obviously a true disaster for the state. But what's worth noting is that Katrina just kind of put the spotlight on what could be argued of several decades of mismanagement. I mean, there always had been this culture of colorful corruption in Louisiana. And the perception that was explained to me down there was that the perception was that really the corrupt governing class was only stealing from the oil and gas companies. The oil and gas companies couldn't really move because that's where the oil and gas was, off the shore of Louisiana. And so the attitude was, yeah, they're a bunch of crooks, but they're not stealing from me. And they spread the money around and, hey, good food, good times. Let's all enjoy New Orleans. And there was kind of this, and for a long time, that worked okay for Louisiana. And then they learned in Katrina just how catastrophic the consequences can be when you have the wrong kind of leaders in charge in a crisis. So Jindal goes in with a state that is more open to trying new ideas than perhaps any other state in the country. He is, at that time, a 37-year-old son of immigrants, Indian American, speaks about 100 words a minute, went to Oxford. I mean, he does not fit the classic prototype of a Louisiana politician. And he goes in there, and I don't think I'm exaggerating much to say he's worked wonders, that the economy is rebounding. State government has been cut by 25%, and no one's really complaining about it. They have consolidated. They have privatized. The schools are doing a heck of a lot better. He has managed crises like Hurricane Gustav and the BP oil spill. I would argue, and obviously I'm biased having spent a lot of time with him, that he's probably the most successful governor in the country right now. And so he deserves this reelection. And I hope every governor in the country of both parties starts, you know, looking to him to take notes and learn from him.
On to number two now, and the man that a lot of people were hoping that Bobby Jindal would run against next year, but he won't, President Obama, once again giving us fits. You know, you give the guy a little bit of credit for killing some terrorists, and then he just does some more stuff that to remind you why you really, really want him to lose next year. This goes back to his effort to implement his jobs plan. With or without congressional approval, you know, Jim, that pesky first article of the Constitution about the legislative branch, we don't need that anymore, at least when it comes to changes to the student loan repayment programs and more housing assistance for mortgage holders who are currently underwater. Needless to say, you have a lot of congressional Republicans who are furious over this since the president has not been able to get any aspects of his jobs bill through other than the trade deals. But this is just a president who just is going to do whatever he's going to do. And the rules and the Constitution, they just get in the way sometimes.
In a way, perhaps we should be asked to not be surprised. Perhaps from here on through November 2012, we can count on the Occupy Wall Street presidency. That there is this mood of anger and frustration and lashing out. And so President Obama will, tuned into that mood. Jesse Jackson was talking about suspending the Constitution and letting Obama spend as much money as he wanted. We shouldn't be surprised to see him making little gestures in that direction. The other thing that's also, I think, very revealing about this is that there's a front page story in the Post on how badly the administration initiatives to help the housing markets and people who are foreclosed and underwater in their houses, how thoroughly they have failed since the beginning of his administration, how none of them have lived up to the hype and none of them have had the impact that the Obama administration hoped that they would have. Which, for looking at the stimulus and various other policies, it's not that surprising. At one point, it said something like there was some meeting in which Obama was stunned to learn how little impact these programs were taking. So once again, the steep learning curve of a guy who really had never run anything before. Secondly, I think it says something about Obama that he really doesn't think that any Republican on Capitol Hill will listen to him. Republicans on Capitol Hill still include the Olympia Snows of the world, the Susan Collins is the world, not Mark Kirk. It's not like every single person in the House and Senate Republican caucus are down-the-line conservatives. So if Barack Obama really has a good idea, he should be able to get a sympathetic hearing out there and, then compromise. But I don't think Obama's interested in this. He's interested in having the campaign issues to run on. And so it's going to be, I'm taking action, and they don't want you to have those action. They want you to be poor and thrown out of your house. And, it's going to be a long 2 years. And it's kind of striking how quickly and how enthusiastically Obama has given up on governing and is ready to go straight towards campaigning.
Yeah, the only thing he knows how to do. It's going to be Wall Street versus Main Street all the way through his campaign next year. Hopefully a majority of the people don't fall for that. But one of the folks that has been rumored out there as a top-flight Republican vice presidential candidate, although he firmly denies any interest in being part of it, but of course that comes with the territory of being considered for vice president, is Marco Rubio, the freshman senator from Florida, rising star of the Republican Party, to be sure, one of the leading conservative voices out there. Well, the Washington Post was not content to just let his star continue to be on the rise without some sort of lame partisan hack attempt to damage his credibility. So late last week, they came out with a story that said that Marco Rubio's family history has been embellished, Jim. Turns out that his family did not flee from Castro's Cuba. They came to the United States in 1956, which is a couple of years before Castro, throughout the Batista regime. And so Marco Rubio's had to do a little bit of explaining, but mostly he's just been furious that he's had to actually dignify this story. So Marco Rubio appearing in this exchange on the Fox News Channel with Trace Gallagher, and first of all, explaining why his parents absolutely were Cuban exiles.
They're right, they got the dates wrong, but the essence of the story doesn't need to be embellished. My parents were exiles. When I was born in May of 1971, I was born to two people who could not return to the nation of their birth because it was under communist control.
And then Trace Gallagher of Fox News says, well, among Cubans, there's a big difference between immigrants and exiles, and exiles are those who came after Castro took over. Here's Rubio's response to that.
No, that's not fair, and that's not true. I mean, first of all, there were a lot of Cubans living in the United States because they weren't happy with the Batista regime to begin with. Are they now not exiles because Fidel Castro took over? Secondly, my parents did try to return. In 1961, my mom moved back to Cuba, and she lived there for 4 weeks, and she realized it was communism, and she came back to the United States just weeks before the Bay of Pigs.
Jim, just a pathetic attempt on the part of the Washington Post to damage this guy's credibility, the fact that his family couldn't live in Cuba because of Castro and possibly even Batista before that is pretty indisputable, as it turns out. And the fact that the Washington Post is dredging up stuff that happened 15 years before Rubio was born means they don't have a lot of real good dirt on him.
This kind of comes on the heels of Univision attempting to blackmail Rubio, basically doing this obsessive. They formed an investigative team, and the first story they did was this arrest of Rubio's uncle, I guess it was. Some relative who was arrested for being involved in a drug smuggling of some kind back when Marco Rubio was 16. So obviously Rubio, the high schooler, is directly responsible for the actions of his relatives. So they begin to do this, and Rubio's like, well, what can I tell you? And they say to him that if you go and do an interview on our show, we may change the tone of the article. And Rubio and his team are kind of stunned at this kind of, blatant blackmail. And Rubio's kind of like, look, it's not that he thinks it's going to affect his political future very much, but he just doesn't want to necessarily put his family through the aggravation and pain of having, you know, really old, dirty laundry dredged up and put up on the front pages. The Miami Herald did a devastating article. They kind of just made Univision look like they were just out to kneecap Rubio. And now the Post does this story, and it's worth noting the Post posted the story up online before Rubio responded. That just kind of tells you how eager they were to get Rubio. And you start thinking, well, what's going on here? Why are we seeing these news organizations that, you know, even if they're not, they don't cover the news the way you or I would, Greg, always had a reasonably professional reputation, suddenly just going unhinged? And the easiest and simplest explanation is, look, Marco Rubio has the potential to be a game changer in American politics. This is a guy who has, besides having this wonderful child of immigrant success story, et cetera, besides the fact that he's so darn eloquent and puts things so well, the fact that he's a rising star, he's from a swing state, et cetera, et cetera. Look, he could be, for Republicans, he could have a very big impact on the Latino vote. And it's, you know, that's a big reason of why he keeps getting mentioned as a potential vice presidential contender, even though he's, I don't know if he's hit 40 yet. This is definitely the, you know, young rising stars who make me feel old. The last thing that the Democrats can let happen, and when I say Democrats, I mean the Washington Post and Univision, that they can't let this rising star rise unimpeded. They've got to take him down a notch, and this is how they're trying to do it. I find it kind of baffling that somehow, I mean, Rubio, every time he's telling these stories, he's telling the stories based on his parents' memories, and, you know, maybe his parents' memories are a little fuzzy on the particular dates of the arrivals, et cetera. Secondly, as he points out, the idea that if you move and suddenly you can't go back to your homeland because there's a new dictator in charge and he's killing people who disagree with him, but you're not really in exile then. This bizarre standard. And then thirdly, Greg, do you remember Richard Blumenthal? He's currently senator from Connecticut, and he lied about serving in Vietnam, and nobody cared all of last year. Like, suddenly that didn't matter at all. But the idea that Rubio is telling family stories wrong, somehow that's, you know, disqualifying. I saw ninnies commenting on comment threads that Rubio will be forced to resign from the Senate over this. And I want to say, where the hell were you last year when Blumenthal was insisting, well, you know, when I said I fought in Vietnam, I meant I fought during Vietnam, and I was not actually in Vietnam. By the end of this campaign cycle, Greg, I suspect we will have the Occupy Wall Street crowd with their Soviet flags insisting that Marco Rubio is soft on communism. That's what the debate is headed to. We are completely detached from facts and reality and truth and all these things that we once considered important.
Well, anything to take it off the actual economic situation, which is exactly what the president doesn't want to have to talk about, unless he can blame other people for it successfully. Jim, bizarre start to the week, but what else will we expect? Talk to you tomorrow.
I'm fired up, Greg. Can't wait till tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.